Whoa, Huawei, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. accuses Chinese tech giant Huawei of stealing secrets from competitors and obstructing justice. The cost to the company could go beyond the U.S. market.
Many countries might be concerned about welcoming a company that has that approach.
Plus, how much did it snow today? Hard to say when it's windy.
It is not uncommon for places in Antarctica to get sustained winds over 100 knots for hours on end.
A lesson in wind and snow and climate change from Antarctica, plus the Haitian specialty that's winning over new fans in Florida.
I need to have pickles, pickles with eggs, pickles with this, pickles with spaghetti, pickles with everything.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Good to have you with us today. At the center of an international dispute between Canada, the U.S., and China is a number and a letter. 5G, a new mobile network technology. The company leading the charge on that is Huawei, the Chinese telecom giant. Here's one of its directors speaking last year at the Mobile World Congress.
5G is coming to us quickly, and we anticipate that 2018 will be the first year for the commercial deployment of the 5G, because the market is getting ready very, very fast.
But now the future looks cloudy at best for Huawei. China says the U.S. is trying to smear and suppress the company. That's after the Justice Department unsealed indictments yesterday against Huawei and one of its executives, Meng Wanzhou. There are charges of stealing trade secrets, obstructing justice, and evading sanctions on Iran. Huawei denies the charges, as does Meng. The U.S., though, is not the only country accusing Huawei of wrongdoing. Several others have either banned the Chinese company or are actively considering shutting it out. Here's Josephine Wolf. She's with the Rochester Institute of Technology and has been following Huawei for years.
Well, Australia's already issued a ban on the use of Huawei equipment in its 5G network. That's sort of the next generation of mobile networks. Germany, we know right now, is sort of talking about considering a ban on Huawei equipment. The British Telecom has basically said it won't use Huawei equipment, though that's not handed down from the government. And meanwhile, Oxford, the university, has just announced that it's not going to take any donations or sponsorships from Huawei in the future. So definitely sort of allies of the United States are getting more concerned about these issues and starting to take real steps to try and block Huawei's technology from being part of their mobile networks.
So what exactly is everyone concerned about? We asked Josephine Wolf with RIT and also Joanna Chu, a reporter who's been covering the Huawei ordeal for the Toronto Star. First, back to Josephine Wolf.
I think a lot of that is tied to concerns about both corporate and political espionage. On the one hand, the kinds of corporate espionage that are referenced in the indictment, which have to do with the company encouraging its employees to steal trade secrets and proprietary intellectual property from competitors. And I think many countries might be concerned about welcoming a company that has that approach to competition. And then the other side of that is sort of political espionage and thinking about if this technology is part of the backbone of our mobile networks, is there a possibility that this is a company that is going to build in some kinds of backdoors or give access about the information going over those networks to the Chinese government? And that's something that's not what Huawei is being accused of here, at least in this indictment, but has also been a concern raised by the U.S. government and by some other governments around using this technology.
Would Canada ban Huawei over security concerns?
Right now, Canada has not made any moves to ban Huawei on grounds of security concerns. And actually,
this is Joanna Chu in Toronto.
Yeah. And Canadian universities actually have about $50 million in partnerships with Huawei for research, mostly in 5G. And 5G is especially controversial because 5G networks are the most cutting edge infrastructure for telecom. So a lot of countries have banned Huawei because they don't want especially Huawei to be so involved in 5G infrastructure, including owning patents. And what's also noteworthy is that Poland, there was a case where Poland actually arrested a Chinese citizen who is a Huawei executive on charges of spying for China.
What is so great about 5G? Like, what is it and how big of a player is Huawei in the 5G space? Is it a monopoly?
It's certainly not a monopoly. Sorry, go ahead.
All right, you go ahead.
Josephine.
Oh, I was just to say it's certainly not a monopoly, but it's really the first generation of wireless technology where we've seen Chinese companies playing a really active role. And so I think in that sense, it's a little disconcerting to some of the Western companies to see it so actively involved in, say, promoting these pilot projects. I think it recently did one in Canada, actually, with TELUS, of sort of building out little pilot networks and really sort of getting involved in the standard setting discussions and the early stages of figuring out what that technology is going to be.
So could other countries end up in a situation where they're not able to build 5G infrastructure without equipment from Huawei?
They could end up owning patents. When they're doing this research with universities, Huawei would have a right to own some of the patents. That means if there's breakthroughs that other countries, other cities would want to put in place, then they may be forced to, you know, use the Huawei technology and the terms of the patents. And Huawei is so attractive to many countries and companies because it's China. It's able to produce equipment at a much cheaper cost than competitors. It's also subsidized as a company by the Chinese state. So it has that competitive advantage of being a Chinese company where companies in China, even if it's nominally private, get a lot of support from the Chinese state. And manufacturing is really cheap there still.
So,
yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's less likely to be a case where countries can't build 5G networks without Huawei technology, but it could very well turn out to be a situation where countries have to spend more money to use other more expensive technologies or perhaps even less efficient technologies if they're not willing to trust any Huawei technology.
Mm-hmm. Like, for example, one expert we interviewed estimated it could cost TELUS and BCE, private companies in Canada, at least $1 billion if Canada decides to ban the equipment made by Huawei, because they would have to develop it on their own and roll back the type of partnerships they've done so far. It's been already years of partnerships between Huawei and many countries and many different companies.
Josephine Wolf, do analysts see this as all being tied up in the U.S.-China trade dispute, or is it a separate set of issues?
I think it's very much tied up in the trade disputes, but I think that those disputes have been somewhat murky about sort of what is motivating the United States government decisions. And this is one of the sort of more concrete and specific sets of accusations that you can point to and say this is at least part of what seems to be behind these trade disputes. And for this part, and again, there are a lot of other reasons that are sometimes invoked for some of the ongoing tensions between U.S. and China, but at least for this part, there seems to be some evidence, there seems to be sort of a real case being built behind this indictment that's finally been unsealed. And I think that's somewhat of a rarity so far in what we've seen around these trade disputes, to have some real concrete accusations in play.
So now that there are indictments in the U.S. for Meng Wanzhou, what happens now? The clock is ticking on an extradition, correct?
Her next court hearing is scheduled for next Tuesday, and that's expected to get the process started for dealing with the extradition process. So it could draw out for months, maybe even a year, because Meng will have a chance to fight extradition. It's not a sure thing. She will be able to have the opportunity to defend herself and resist being sent to the U.S. by Canada.
We will leave it there. Joanna Chu with the Toronto Star and Josephine Wolf with the Rochester Institute of Technology. Thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's going to be colder this week in some U.S. cities than in Antarctica. Thank you, Polar Vortex. Here in Boston, we're also getting some snow. Not much, but still measurable. Now, measuring snowfall accurately in Antarctica, that's not easy to do, but it is critical for scientists trying to understand how much the ice on the continent is melting. Caitlin Sachs is a science editor with NOVA here at WGBH, and she recently got back from McMurdo Station, the main U.S. science base in Antarctica, where she met up with a team of scientists studying this snowfall business. Why is measuring how much snow falls on Antarctica so important, Caitlin?
Well, it really comes back to a climate change question. The amount of precipitation that falls out on the continent affects how much moisture is left in the ocean, and so it becomes a question of sea level. When I was down there in Antarctica, I drove out onto the ice shelf in a truck with some of the researchers, and one of them, Scott Landolt from the National Center for Atmospheric Research, explained it to me.
There's been all of these predictions of as the ice sheets and stuff start to melt off down here, we're starting to see a lot of predictions of ocean rises around the planet. But one thing that's not really been taken into account very well is the offset of accumulation.
Scott told me that's because there's really no good way to measure snowfall in these remote locations like Antarctica or Greenland. They can indirectly estimate the total accumulation, but they can't measure snowfall directly like we can here.
I mean, wouldn't like a rudimentary measurement like just sticking a ruler in the snow, wouldn't that at least give you a general sense of how much snow came down?
Well, the first problem is who's going to stick that ruler in the snow? Remember, Antarctica is in 24 hours of darkness for its entire winter, and it can get down to negative 60, negative 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So this system needs to be automatic.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Who wants to go out at 4 in the morning to measure snow in that kind of weather?
And that's only one problem. The other problem is the wind. It's not uncommon to get sustained winds of up to 100 miles per hour, and it's totally unpredictable. When I was out on the ice shelf, the wind kicked up right when we were out there.
It's gotten a little windy out here.
Just a little bit, yeah.
And the ice, the ground, starts to look like it's flowing like an ocean because the snow is blowing across the surface. And that's really the second challenge.
When you're trying to measure snow and the snow is blowing horizontally instead of falling vertically into your precipitation gauge, it really presents a challenge of how do you get that wind to slow down so that the snow will actually fall out of it instead of just blowing past your gauge.
I can hear the wind right there.
Yeah. So that's why I was out there with these guys. They're trying to figure out how to fix that problem and how to set up an automatic snowfall measuring system in really the most inhospitable continent on Earth.
So what are they trying?
Well, it actually amounts to what sounds like a relatively simple solution. They have these metal fins arranged in two concentric circles. They kind of look like two fences around an instrument, which is essentially a high-tech bucket which collects and weighs the snow. And these metal fins, you can actually hear them in the background.
We like to call these the Antarctic wind chimes.
But they block a surprising amount of wind. When it got really windy, I went inside to where Scott Landall, the researcher, was working on the instrument.
Slide under here.
And it was still loud, but I really couldn't feel any wind.
It's nice and toasty in here.
Uh-huh. It's actually not bad once you get down inside the shield itself. Noisy, but there's almost no wind blowing past us.
So that's pretty cool. It's like a high-tech windbreak, but actually a pretty simple solution. Big question, though. Is it working? Are they measuring snowfall, and what are they finding?
Yes. So this was the first year of the study, and they are able to measure snowfall and get that data sent back to them in the States in the middle of the Antarctic winter, which is really amazing. They still do have some hurdles to overcome. They don't have a continuous record of snowfall for an entire season. But ultimately, the hope is to develop something that they can deploy widely across the continent so that we have a lot of stations getting snowfall in a lot of places. And that way, we can really feed that into our models and better understand what's going to happen in the future.
So, Caitlin, I know this is a pilot project, but we hear so much about ice melting in Antarctica, and it's really potentially pretty dire news. The snowfall that scientists are learning how to measure, can it possibly counteract the melting or at least change our understanding of climate change in Antarctica?
Well, it's certainly an active area of debate, in part because this snowfall parameter is so poorly understood. But I would say most scientists don't think that it would totally counteract how much ice we're losing at the margins of the continent. We have to remember that there are parts of Antarctica that are at risk of really catastrophically collapsing and melting away. And if that happens, it will happen really fast, much faster than precipitation is accumulating on the continent.
Caitlin Sachs from our WGBH partners at NOVA. Caitlin's reporting was supported by the National Science Foundation. Caitlin, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
We've got photos of the wild and windy landscape in Antarctica over theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. In West Africa, Nigeria is preparing for a presidential election next month. There's a big concern about the vote, that attacks by Boko Haram extremists could interfere with a free and fair election. The Nigerian government's fight against the militants has intensified, but so has a controversial effort to de-radicalize and rehabilitate some of its fighters. The program involves former Boko Haram members who voluntarily surrendered to authorities. The BBC's Isaac Khalid visited the program's facility in Nigeria's Gombe State.
On the outskirts of a town in Gombe State, northeastern Nigeria, is a complex which the government hopes can help end its 10-year fight against Boko Haram. We were granted access to the de-radicalization facility on condition we didn't reveal its exact location. This de-radicalization camp is vast. It looks like a big secondary school with classrooms and administrative buildings. The security here is tight with concrete barriers at the gate and barbed wire, and there are soldiers on guard as well. The former Boko Haram militants are dressed in their light brown uniforms. 19-year-old Mohammed is one of those former fighters. He says he was abducted and forced to join the group 6 years ago when his village was overrun by militants. He tells me he was involved in several attacks on villages until he surrendered to the Nigerian military in 2017.
My life in Boko Haram was terrible. It was not fair. I found myself living a bad life. I did not enjoy it at all. Only later, I realized being a Boko Haram member was very wrong.
There are 154 ex-militants in the camp who have opted for a new life and pledged allegiance to the Nigerian government. They are the second batch of the ex-Boko Haram members who have completed the 12-month program, which involved psychosocial support and religious reorientation. Part of the rehabilitation process is teaching the former Boko Haram members vocational skills, such as tailoring, carpentry, cosmetics, and even poultry. I'm in a tailoring shop in this camp, and I can see dozens of former Boko Haram members here, each on his own sewing machine. And the idea basically is to give them some sources of legitimate income when they are finally released back into their own communities. Whilst I watch, Mohammed makes a pair of slippers.
The shoemaking that I have learned will help me live a decent life when I go back home. Wherever I go, it will give me some income. But whenever I reflect on what we did in Boko Haram, I feel very bad. We are seeking forgiveness from our victims, our parents, and the rest of the world. We are now reformed people. We have been reformed in this camp. We need forgiveness.
The former fighters are to be reintegrated into local communities. But many people, especially those who have suffered, feel threatened by the prospect. Salamatu Shettima's life has been shattered. She tells me she has lost her husband and 7 of her 8 children to Boko Haram violence 3 years ago.
If they have truly repented and they are sure they will not commit such acts again, I can forgive them. But I will not forget. I will never forget. It is impossible.
According to security analyst Kabiru Adamu, preventing the former Boko Haram members from rejoining the group is not guaranteed.
There is no evidence suggests that these members have gone back to the group.
But, you know, having a military running such a program and then to have people change their ideological standing based on a military-run program, I guess it's almost impossible.
Kabiru Adamu says one of the problems is that the living conditions that led the young men to join Boko Haram have not changed.
So irrespective of what you put them through, if they still come out and meet those conditions on the ground, then the likelihood is they would be either tempted to go back to join those groups or in some instances forced, because it's a choice between joining government or joining these groups, armed groups.
However, the authorities are confident. Colonel Beidi Gurama Martins is in charge of the camp.
I'm very certain that they are not going to go back into the act, considering what the program is designed to achieve. They have been thoroughly prepared, trained, and organized to ensure that they are properly monitored over a long period and with the expectation that it will not have a relapse. This remains one of the most plausible options other than combat operations that should be used against this sect in order to bring this violence to an end.
But with a recent increase in Boko Haram attacks in the northeast of Nigeria, the de-radicalization program is still a drop in the ocean in the deadly fight against the group.
The BBC's Isaac Khalid reporting there from Gombe State in Nigeria. Quick sharp turn now. If you're a fan of pickled things like I am, there's a new Haitian specialty you need to know about. Nadege Green with station WLRN in Miami has that story.
Cynthia Verna is a Haitian chef. Everyone calls her Chef Tia. And she says her friends are always asking her to make picles for them.
I have more of my Puerto Rican, my Cuban, my Dominican. Oh, forget about the Dominicans. I need to have picles, picles with eggs, picles with this, picles with spaghetti, picles with everything.
Some people describe picles as a spicy vinegar coleslaw or a Haitian spicy kimchi. The condiment comes with most savory Haitian dishes. Chef Tia is preparing a small batch. First, she chops up some cabbage. She uses a grater to shred some carrots and then the heart of the picles, the Scotch bonnet pepper.
More spicier, like fiery. We want the seed in there, okay? We want to chop the seed, so I'm going to go.
Chef Tia grew up in Pétionville, Haiti, and she started making picles when she was about 7 or 8. She says picles is the perfect condiment. It doesn't need any refrigeration, and it actually gets better with time. And it's easy to get, too. Locally, some grocery stores like Publix, Winn-Dixie, and Walmart carry it. And Haitian picles is making its way into non-Haitian restaurants. In Little Haiti in Miami, there's a Chinese restaurant that serves fried rice and egg rolls with a side of picles. A few blocks down, Claude Postel is the owner and chef at 6010, an organic rotisserie chicken restaurant. He's from France.
This beautiful paper there, you know, it's just wonderful, you know.
This isn't too surprising. A lot of Haitians work in the restaurant industry here.
We have a Haitian cook who's working with me for a long time, you know, and he teach me how to make it.
Haitian entrepreneurs are also capitalizing on the popularity of picles by making the spicy condiment and selling it in glass jars. Georges Ebelaguer runs a small cafe in Little Haiti. He goes by Tijoge. Tijoge says, depending on where you're from in Haiti, every picles has its own special touch.
You go to the northern part, you find another style. Then you come to the central part of Haiti, you find another style.
The base is always cabbage and carrots.
I recall observing my grandmother making her own style of picles. She will get the green beans, mince them out, and she will put shallots in it, and also sour oranges.
And when people ask Tijoge, what do you put picles on?
I'm going to say on everything.
Picles on everything. For the World, Nadege Green, Miami.
I'm Marco Werman. In Venezuela, a fight over who is the president. And in the meantime, political prisoners languish.
I ask for freedom of the political prisoner. I ask for the freedom of my husband, Leopoldo Lopez, and all the political prisoners in Venezuela.
The wife of one of Venezuela's most prominent political detainees speaks out right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Venezuelans who speak out against the government of President Nicolas Maduro, they take a big risk.
All around my house, we have the police of Maduro, the police of the dictator. Every 4 hours, they take a picture of my husband, Leopoldo Lopez, with a newspaper in his hand, like a kidnapping. It's crazy.
That's Venezuelan opposition activist Lilian Tintori. Her husband, as you just heard, is Leopoldo Lopez, the country's most prominent political prisoner. He's under house arrest, serving a 14-year sentence for inciting violence during mass protests back in 2014. Lopez is also a mentor to Juan Guaido, the opposition leader who declared himself Venezuela's interim president last week. Lilian Tintori says Guaido has broad popular support, and that is efforts against Maduro are gaining steam.
We are full of hope because we have a new president, Juan Guaido. He's a new president by the Constitution. He's the new president by the people. We want democracy and we want a transition in peace. 90% of the people support our president, Juan Guaido.
Yeah, but a lot of people still support President Maduro. How can you be so hopeful when there are a lot of people who still support the elected president?
That's not true. Maduro is alone. The only thing have Maduro is the arms, militaries and police with arms. And right now, he ordered to kill people who protest. People are protesting in Venezuela because they don't have food, they don't have medicine, they don't have gas, water, or light. And people want a change, a political change, economic change.
Lilian Tintori, your husband is under house arrest. He was sentenced to 13 years in prison. And how is he still a part of the movement? Is he able to talk to people outside of his incarceration?
Yes. Well, first, I want to be clear that Leopoldo never, never called for violence. We don't want violence. And Leopoldo López was the first one that denounced Maduro, a dictatorship. And that's why Leopoldo López is in jail. Right now, he's in house arrest. And here in our home, he made a plan for our country with a lot of people, very good people around the world, to support and continue this transition that already started. We don't want confrontation. We want reconciliation. We want militaries and police put in the side of the Constitution and put in order of President Juan Guaido.
As your husband was in detention, you met with President Trump in 2017. What were your impressions of that meeting?
It was a very good meeting. In that meeting, I asked for freedom of the political prisoner. I asked for the freedom of my husband, Leopoldo López, and all the political prisoners in Venezuela. And I relate the crisis, the humanitarian crisis. And in that moment, I know the United States very clear, and I say thank you for all the support.
What were your impressions of President Trump, of Donald Trump as a person?
It's like wow, this is incredible. The same of Vice President Pence. Vice President Pence was very kind and very worried about Venezuelan people.
Well, as you know, the Trump administration is now an active supporter of your movement, and they've endorsed Juan Guaido, who has declared himself interim president of the country. Do you have any second thoughts about that? Does it play into a narrative that your movement is taking orders from the U.S., that your movement is a puppet of the U.S.?
Well, the United States and all the countries around the world need to support the people of Venezuela. Supporting President Juan Guaido, you are supporting the law, you are supporting human rights, you are supporting people in Venezuela. So this is the right direction, and we ask for countries that right now are waiting, don't wait. Talk, support, raise your voice loud, and support this transition.
But aren't you worried with the United States, with Canada, with the EU endorsing Juan Guaido, that that's going to hurt your movement because it's not Venezuelans voicing their concerns? It's outside voices.
No. It's our voices. It's our protest. We protest in the street in 2014. We protest in the street in 2017. We are brave here in Venezuela every day because Venezuelan people are in risk. Right now, is our voice, is our entire hope for the change. We thank you to support the international community, but it's here, inside, it's in Venezuela, it's in our country. And we need to remember, first, stop Maduro. Second, a government of transition and free and fair election. That's our plan. That's what we're working all together, all the opposition together, opposition inside Venezuela, opposition outside Venezuela, because we want to remember that we have political prisoners, but we have a lot of exile, political in exile. And there, everyone is working for peace, for democracy, and for a change in Venezuela.
human rights activist Lilian Tintori. She's also the wife of the imprisoned Venezuelan opposition leader Leopoldo López. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
The UK is grinding its way toward March 29th. That's the date for Britain's scheduled breakup with the European Union. Parliament today voted down a proposal to push back the deadline. And of course, there's still no clear plan on how leaving the EU will work. Many Brits worry that after Brexit, there will be shortages of food and medicine. Enter James Blake. He's come up with a Brexit survival kit. It's called the Brexit Box. I gather you brought a box in, or at least a version of the Brexit box.
Yes.
What's in it?
Okay, so in the Brexit box, you get tins of fuel your preparation food. It is freeze-dried, and the tin has a 25-year shelf life.
It's a tin of what? Freeze-dried what?
It's freeze-dried food. So the one I have in my hand right now is chicken tikka with rice.
Oh, okay.
And all you do is you add water, and it goes back to its original state. And so it's designed for emergencies. It's designed for an emergency food. So it is nutritious, and it gives you the calories that you need for that to see you through an emergency environment.
Chicken tikka with rice. I mean, isn't that kind of like the standard curry you might get at a pub or any kind of Indian curry house?
Yeah.
And you're worried that that might suffer as a result of a hard Brexit, a crash out?
Yeah, there's quite a possibility. Shops, supermarkets, hauliers are all confirming that there will be an issue at the borders if there is a no-deal Brexit. And it goes against what the government says, which the government says there won't be any problem whatsoever. But the businesses are saying, yeah, they will.
James, I'm going to get personal. Did you vote to stay or to leave the EU?
Leave.
You voted to leave. So there's no satire here. You are sincerely concerned about what might happen on the 29th of March.
Yes. Definitely. You know, we're in an unprecedented period of time where not even our government really knows what's going on. And we've got 2 months left. This thing should have been sorted out by now. And it isn't. It's dragging on. And there's a very real possibility of crashing out. I don't like the word crashing, but that's how it's projected. Yeah. Crashing out of the EU without a deal. Now, I don't think leaving the EU without a deal is a terrible thing. Ideally, it would be better to have a deal. The problem is that nobody's worked on the no-deal scenario, which means that there generally isn't very many plans in place to deal with what happens after March 29th when we leave.
So how much does this box cost? Like, how many people have bought this Brexit survival kit already?
Okay, so its retail price, I recommend retail price, works out at £384, but we have it discounted to £229. And we've done that to try to help as many people as possible. We make very little profit on this box, but we felt it was such an important issue to try to help people to be prepared. And it protects people from having a run on the supermarkets, which we really don't want to happen. We don't want panic buying to happen. We want people to start being prepared now. As a matter of, we've sold quite a lot more than we were expecting. We're doing approximately about 20 to 25 units a day.
£384, that's the pre-reduction price. That's about $506.
That's right.
How many meals do you get for that?
Okay, so you get 60 main meals. That is a single portion meal. Plus you get 2 tins, which gives you 48 portions in total of freeze-dried chicken and freeze-dried minced beef so that you can create your own food. Plus, you also get a water filter and a bottle of firelighter gel just so that you can deal with any situation.
I mean, it's starting to feel like Y2K or, you know, people prepping for the end of the world. Aren't you sending that kind of message?
No, not at all. We are a preparedness company. We've been around for 10 years doing preparedness. Look, we buy car insurance, we buy home insurance on an annual basis for just that scenario, hoping that we never have to use it. You know, if a car burns down or a house burns down, we hope that never happens. And this is the same sort of thing. It's a food insurance.
If there is a hard exit from the EU, what would you miss most in terms of food products from the continent?
I think that we will sort things out. I don't think we're going to miss things per se, because I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a short-term disruption. And that's what this box is designed for about, you know, 20 to 30 days worth of disruption. We're not talking about months or years worth of, you know, that we're never going to have cheese again, or we're never going to have champagne ever again. It's just talking about the very short-term disruption to our food supply and having a very concise but short-term solution to that. Look, if we do have a no deal, at the moment, I think no deal is better than the deal that's being proposed. But if we do have a no deal, it hurts Europe as much as it does with us. And I very much feel that if we do go through that process, I think it's going to be very quickly put on the table again about trying to get a deal in place for both sides, because both sides are going to hurt by that.
James Blake, the co-founder of the Brexit Box, he's been speaking with us from the BBC Leeds studio. Thanks very much for your time today, James.
Thanks.
I know it seems like it, but they're not just talking Brexit in Parliament over there on the other side of the pond. An anti-domestic violence bill is also making its way through the British Parliament. This piece of legislation would do something that's not on the books here in the US. It would broaden the definition of domestic violence to include economic abuse. The world's Alison Herrera has that story.
The thing that Anna remembers most about her 14-year marriage? Constantly being broke.
So I was working 60 hours a week. I had three jobs and I was still overdrawn. I had no money whatsoever with all this money coming in because it was all going to him to fund his lifestyle of luxury.
Anna, that's a pseudonym. She wanted me to protect her identity. She says her husband would go off on expensive weekend sprees, racking up credit card debt that came out of their joint account. She says when that was tapped out, the bank went after her husband's personal account, and he blew up.
And he said that I had completely and utterly embarrassed him and how dare they use his money. And he tried to punch me in the face in the town centre at lunchtime in full view of hundreds of people.
That was it for Anna. She left her husband. But before that happened, she says, he forced her to co-sign a loan to cover the bank fees, which left her saddled with debt. He never paid any of it. According to Nicole Sharp, that is financial abuse, and the legislation now being considered in the UK Parliament defines it as a form of domestic violence.
It does serve the purpose of raising awareness, so it gives this form of abuse legal status and means that there has never been so much attention on it.
Sharp is the director of an organization called Surviving Economic Abuse. She says the financial coercion that Anna endured can be hard to prove.
Because unlike physical violence, for example, there are no physical injuries to see. At the moment, you could talk about those behaviours as being coercive or controlling behaviours. But what we found in relation to this piece of legislation is that when people are charged with this offence, it is usually alongside a physical or a sexual offence. It's very rare to see a coercive or controlling behaviour offence prosecuted on its own.
But under the legislation, financial abuse could lead to stiffer penalties. The bill would also encourage police to look into financial as well as physical abuse. And it would provide funding to bank officers to recognize the signs of financial coercion. Penny East, who works with the UK-based organization called Safe Lives, says that's a big deal because loan officers could change the outcome.
For example, if a woman was to go into her bank and ask to take out a large loan, rather than just letting her sign the document, it's just about having that question or having that training, just to double check, you know, you're completely happy with the loan. You are choosing to make that you have chosen this independently to take out this loan, et cetera, et cetera.
In Anna's case, she says a question like that might have kept her from taking out that loan in her own name to cover her husband's expenses. In retrospect, she wishes a loan officer had looked at their bank statements and stepped in.
In my mind, if someone had known what they were looking for, it would have been really obvious looking at our bank statements as to what was going on.
In the United States, there's an effort to amend the Violence Against Women Act to include financial abuse. For Anna, she welcomes the proposed UK legislation, though it's been slowed down by the Brexit negotiations. She thinks it gives a name to what her husband did to her.
I genuinely did not see his behaviours as being abusive.
Anna says it took 15 years, but she finally paid off that debt. She just hopes that other people won't have to go through what she did. For The World, I'm Alison Herrera.
President Trump says he's looking forward to meeting again with North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Their next summit is planned for late February. And the venue, though not official yet, is expected to be Vietnam. The World's Matthew Bell explains why that choice makes sense for everybody.
Why Vietnam?
from the U.S. perspective, the country is a shining example of what North Korea's future could look like.
We know it's a real possibility because we see how Vietnam has traveled this remarkable path.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, speaking in Hanoi last summer, described Vietnam's post-war economic success as a miracle, something the North Koreans could pull off, too. Pompeo suggested the turning point for Vietnam came just 20 years after the fall of Saigon. It was 1995 when the U.S. and Vietnam reestablished diplomatic relations. From the Vietnamese capital, Pompeo had this message for the dictator back in North Korea.
President Trump believes your country can replicate this path. It's yours if you'll seize the moment. The miracle can be yours. It can be your miracle in North Korea as well.
From Washington's perspective, Vietnam is a country that's gone from historic enemy to important partner. Zachary Abuza is an expert on Southeast Asia at the National War College. He says the U.S.-Vietnam relationship is growing closer and closer.
We have seen just a surge in U.S. investment in the country. Vietnam very much wanted to be part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It did more than any other country to meet the requirements to gain entry. They've increased their military relationship with the United States. We had the first port visit this last year of a U.S. aircraft carrier.
The Vietnamese would be keen to play host for Trump and Kim, Abuza says. It's an opportunity to be in the international spotlight, to be relevant. He says it's also a chance for Vietnam's leaders to help this American president engage with the region.
They understand that Trump is a transactional president, and the ability to host a major summit, something that really matters to the president, is something that they have to offer him.
Vietnam as a summit venue would work well for North Korea, too, starting with a practical reason, says Sung-yeon Lee, a Korea expert at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
It's ironic that North Korea has the capability to shoot an intercontinental ballistic missile that can reach Washington, D.C., some 13,000 kilometers away, but doesn't have the technology to build an airplane, a passenger airplane, that can travel more than 4,000 kilometers or so.
And flying in a North Korean plane is probably a must for Kim when he travels to meet the U.S. president. So the venue has to be within range. That reportedly ruled out Switzerland, where Kim Jong-un went to boarding school. He would have needed to hitch a ride on a Chinese plane for that trip. Vietnam is not just closer geographically to the North Korean regime. Sung-yeon Lee says the national narratives of the two communist countries also resonate.
Vietnam has been a shining model of communist-led unification for the North Korean regime for decades now.
Victory over the American imperialists.
Indeed, and also being able to deceive the American imperialists to compel them to withdraw and then effectively take over.
But what about Vietnam's economic miracle, the one Mike Pompeo talks about, the booming trade that Vietnam has developed with the U.S., with South Korea and its neighbors? Isn't that an enticing option for North Korea's leader? Lee says not if Washington insists that Kim gives up his nuclear weapons first.
The longer this negotiation process goes on, the more time and money Kim Jong-un will be able to buy to do what he really seeks, which is to further advance his lethal nuclear and ballistic missile capabilities.
No matter where the second Trump-Kim summit might take place, Vietnam or elsewhere, there's a growing consensus on this point. Today, the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, delivered a report to Congress saying North Korea is unlikely to denuclearize, which, of course, was the whole point for President Trump meeting Kim Jong-un in the first place. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
My aunt, in the last years of her life, suffered from dementia. Sometimes she couldn't remember who I was, but she still knew Passover songs by heart that she learned as a girl decades earlier. Tiny artifacts of things from the past, like music and even smells, can get wired into the brains of people with dementia. Lenny White knows that better than most. He's a barber in Northern Ireland. His clients are mostly elderly men with dementia living in nursing homes. And what Lenny does is he recreates an old-fashioned barbershop and brings it to them.
So I'll go in and I'll bring, first of all, the jukebox. So it has like Dean Martin and Elvis Presley and all Frank Sinatra's and all those sort of songs that these men would have listened to, you know, years ago when they were young. Volare. And that music is sort of playing in the background before they come in. I will then set up the room with my big barber pole, like a barber pole that you would have on the front of a shop. So I carry that around with me and I set that up in the room. And then you have the smells in the room. So I'll spray the room with like a lemon cologne and use things like old-fashioned soaps to get like a smell and an aroma in the room before these men actually come in. So when these men walk into that room, they're getting a sensory experience. And some of these guys maybe sometimes don't remember me, but when they, maybe a few minutes into it, they'll go, I know you, don't I? And I'll go, yes. And well, wasn't I here before? I said, yes, you were. You were here a few weeks ago. Oh, yes, I remember that music and I remember that barber pole. And the memories will start coming back and they'll start remembering, yes, I was here before. Maybe guys that maybe can't communicate and maybe the non-verbal now, you'll see maybe a little tap of their feet. And you know that the music is going into the brain. It's registering with the body.
Gonna make a sentimental journey to renew old memories.
I enjoy especially coming here. He gets such treatment. And he doesn't rush you. And he makes you feel quite at home.
The music brings back memories of my younger life, or younger days. Lenny makes a good job. I think I'm handsome after I get my hair cut.
It's not always easy. I mean, it isn't a modern cut that we'll do because these men are, you know, they're older. So we'll do a nice little, you know, short back and sides and a little maybe sweep over to the right or the sweep over to the left. And so it's looking quite an old-fashioned cut. I mean, these small things make a massive difference to these men because these men, they've looked after themselves so well on a daily basis. And now they're at the stage in their lives where, you know, they're not able to do that. So I'm able to give them back a bit of that dignity.
I like that guy and his story a lot. Lenny White, a.k.a. Lenny the Mobile Barber, speaking there to the BBC in Northern Ireland. And that's going to do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.